Happy New Year to you. This is Dr. Jerry Newcomb on Vocal Points, and what a great way to start the year. We're having a guest back on by popular demand, at least my popular demand. I love this guy. His name is Dr. Stephen Meyer. He earned his PhD at Cambridge University. He's written a New York Times bestselling book called Darwin's Doubt. And we're going to talk about a subject. There's a story recently in Los Angeles where at the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles, they removed a reference to God because God has no place in science, according to the museum arbitrators. And we're going to talk about that issue in general, not just that particular story. Dr. Meyer, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on again, Jerry.
Sure. Okay, here's the story. The Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History has removed a reference to God in an exhibition space for visitors, according to reports. An inscription in the museum's new nature lab that referenced God was taken down from the space in mid-December. What are your comments?
Well, I think what's interesting about the... we have these, you know, we're at the time of year where we have... just had all this debate about the war on Christmas and this forced secularization of our culture that's going on, and certainly this is an example of that. But what's really interesting to me is the way is part of the rationale that the museum used. They viewed this statement about a donor had given them money and had encouraged them to put a statement like this up, and it said something about celebrating the natural world and all the creatures that God has made, you know, a very innocuous but pro-theistic statement. The museum directors regarded this as an attack on evolutionary theory, which I think is really interesting because it reveals that that the proponents of evolution in many museums, certainly in many textbooks, do not regard the theory which they're teaching to our children and promulgating to the public as a religiously neutral idea. They, in fact, are not theistic evolutionists. They don't believe that there is design guiding the process. They think that this is a purely unguided, undirected process, and that anyone who affirms even the existence of a creator behind it all is making an attack on evolution. There was no statement of attacking Darwinian theory in this, but what it reveals is that they believe that the evolutionary theory that they're teaching to our kids is, in fact, a purely materialistic theory, and that's consistent with what we've long understood about Darwinism. Darwinian theory attempts to explain the appearance of design by reference to an unguided, undirected process that merely mimics the powers of a designing intelligence, and so it is effectively... an atheistic or materialistic version of the account of biological origins. And what's interesting is while these folks felt that this was an affront to the First Amendment, in fact, by their own tacit admission, they're acknowledging that the form of evolutionary theory that they are teaching and promoting to the public is a non-neutral theory with respect to the First Amendment. It has clear materialistic and atheistic implications, and the way you know that is the way they react to even such an innocuous statement as was on the front of the museum.
Mm-hmm. Here's the actual statement in question, quote, and this, by the way, comes from an anonymous donor to the museum. The Nature Lab is a gift to Los Angeles to celebrate all of God's creatures and enable NHM, which is... the Natural History Museum.
Yeah.
Right, to broaden our understanding of the natural world through the process of scientific discovery. So it's that reference to God and God's creatures.
Pretty offensive, huh?
That was the problem. Yeah.
But see, what this tells you is what this mostly reveals is the mindset of the people who work in these museums. There are similar statements in our biological textbooks. Evolution works without plan or purpose, says one. Another tells us that Darwin's theory made it possible to eliminate spiritual, made spiritual explanations of life superfluous. when talking to the public, the defenders of the Darwin-only science education approach will tell people, oh, well, evolution and belief in God are compatible. There's no problem here. But what the form of the theory they're teaching is straight up Darwinism, or what's now called modern neo-Darwinism. And neo-Darwinism and Darwinism have long been explicit that there is no design evident in nature. Yes, things look designed, but the design is there as the result of an unguided, undirected process. So they will, in their technical literature, in the technical articles, or when talking to each other in science conferences, or the understanding that they're conveying to students and the public is that we have design without a designer. It's a purely materialistic process of creation. And so if that's true, that has decidedly anti-theistic implications. So it's not a theologically neutral concept,
yep.
And it itself is a violation of the First Amendment on those grounds.
That's true.
And yet they take offense at this very innocuous statement as allegedly a violation of the First Amendment. And I think actually that whole issue is confused from the standpoint of jurisprudence. Our Declaration of Independence makes reference to a creator.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it says that that we are made in the by a creator is the guarantee of our inalienable rights.
Right.
But nevertheless, I think what's interesting is this evolution debate is often turned against defenders of a traditional theistic perspective. And those folks are made to feel as if they've done something wrong or unconstitutional by affirming publicly that they believe in a creator or a God, and as if that's a violation of the First Amendment. But I think the shoe is actually on the other foot, and the way these folks have reacted has shown that they are actually promulgating a very non-neutral concept, which they themselves understand to be non-neutral with respect to the First Amendment. They believe that Darwinism is supporting atheistic materialism, and there's a lot of tax money behind that ideology.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting, too. There was a Supreme Court decision, and I know this is from a footnote from that decision, but it was called Torcaso v. Watkins, 1961. And in it, they talked about how do we define a religion, and they said that some belief systems could be viewed as a religion, and included in that group was secular humanism and, you know, all sorts of different ways to understand the world. And so what the founders gave us was they did not want any one denomination to lord it over the others. So it was kind of like, let's put all the sects, they like to use that word, S-E-C-T-S, let's put all the denominations on an equal footing, not allow one church to be at the national level.
But they were operating
superior
within a broadly theistic framework.
Oh, absolutely.
That affirmed that there was a creator.
Yep.
And that creator had endowed human beings with inalienable rights, and that was the metaphysical foundation of all the rights and freedoms that we enjoy. There is a worldview implicit in our constitutional system.
Absolutely. And it's a Christian one.
Yeah,
or you could say Judeo-Christian one.
I think it's broadly Judeo-Christian, and you know there were a few deists among the founders, but not actually that many. Even Jefferson, who's touted as being a deist, is probably more aptly described as a Unitarian theist. He was not a Christian,
and that's at the end of his life.
Yeah,
that's at the end of his life.
Yeah,
where at the time that he wrote, at the time I'm working on a book that I'm co-writing on Jefferson, and it's been years that we've been working on this. At the time that he wrote the Declaration of Independence, a year later, 1777, Jefferson wrote the bylaws, the subscription, basically the charter papers for a new church, the Calvinistical Reformed Church of Charlottesville, Virginia. They hired the Reverend Charles Clay, who was ordained as an Anglican, but basically was one of the few evangelicals among Virginia Anglican ministers at the time, and he was the one they hired. And I'm telling you, it was an amazing thing. Now, later, there's no question that Jefferson's thinking turned toward the Unitarian side of things, especially in the last 13, 14 years of his life. But anyway, in any event, at the time you have the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, they are absolutely operating out of a theistic worldview. There's not even a question of that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I didn't know about his involvement with a church, but I used to teach political philosophy, and what I used to tell my students about the founding is that it was based on on two key propositions. I call them the twin pillars of constitutional thought, which one of which was the intrinsic dignity of human beings, which was, in the view of the founders, derived from the fact of man's divine origin and divine creation. Mm-hmm. And the other pillar was the depravity of human beings, that humans were capable of great evil, and if power was concentrated in the hands of just a few, that represented a peril to everyone else, thus the need for separation of powers. So, these two pillars of constitutional thought are clearly coming out of a Judeo-Christian framework, whatever the individual belief systems of the, you know, whatever denominations or belief systems of the individual founders. I think this was the worldview that informed the thinking. So now you fast forward the clock 240 years, and we have people who are saying that any mention of a deity, even in an innocuous statement of civil religion, is an offense to the very constitutional order that the founders initiated, and it's completely nonsensical. How can it be contrary to the constitutional principles when they initiated, when those principles were based on that very worldview foundation?
That's so true, and the Constitution is even signed in the year of our Lord, 1787. All right, now, I've got a quote for you. This is from Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, the last paragraph. Quote, "There is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved." So here's Darwin referring to a creator. Would Darwin's writings be allowed
at the close of The Origin of Species be deemed anti-evolutionary? I don't think so.
Well, but would it be allowed at the Museum of Natural History? He's referring to a creator.
Probably not. And what you see is animating this whole agenda is a radical form of forced secularization of the culture. There's a group operating now that's called the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and they've gone after a scientist at the at Ball State University in Indiana. He was teaching a course in on the boundaries of science. It was a philosophy of science course, and he assigned to his students one book that was critical of the theory of intelligent design and one book that was supportive of it, to get at this question: what is the nature and definition of science? What are the boundaries of science? And this group, or the University of Chicago, evolutionary biologist named Jerry Coyne, and a group closely associated with him called the Freedom From Religion Foundation, protested to the university in another state to try to get this guy removed from teaching, to get his course suppressed. And there's now a kind of academic inquisition going on where his teaching methods are being scrutinized by a committee of other faculty members. And there has been a statement by the president of the university forbidding any discussion of the idea of intelligent design in any science classroom in the university. Well, this is the kind of thing that's going on. It's really part of a piece. And again, what I find most interesting about it is that the defenders of modern neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory, the textbook version that we all learn, are actually revealing in their reaction to a professor like Eric Hedin at Ball State, or this innocuous statement on the at the Museum of Natural History in Los Angeles, that their own understanding of biological origins and the theory that they're teaching is implicitly atheistic. And the way you know that is if anyone affirms a theistic understanding of the natural world, they themselves will say that that affirmation is anti-evolutionary. So I think this case is similar to many others in that it's based on a flawed understanding of church-state jurisprudence, and you and I were just discussing that. But it also is interesting because it reveals the extent to which the proponents of modern evolutionary theory view their theory as something that's affirming materialism or atheism.
Mm. All right, we're talking right now with Stephen Meyer, author of the book Darwin's Doubt. And we are talking about some of the ways in which God is being censored out. For example, in the Museum of Natural History in Los Angeles, they took down a sign that where an anonymous donor mentioned God or God's creatures, and well, you can't mention God here. This is a museum about science. But going back to my question about Darwin, here he's referring in The Origin of the Species itself, which gave birth to, that's the origin really of evolution, at least in the modern way. Then here he's referring to the creator. Doesn't that, in a sense, put him in the same category as that plaque that they took down from the museum? I mean, just to mention a creator, God, that's verboten.
Yeah, I think it would. The thing I think historically, many historians of science have interpreted that statement at the end of The Origin of Species as a kind of rhetorical hat tip on Darwin's part to the broader Victorian religious culture, and he was, in a sense, they think it was a political statement on his part, trying to keep himself out of trouble with the dominant, theistic institutions, the Church of England, and so forth at the time. And that's really it's hard to know. It is clear, though, that in Darwin's own theory, he does deny that there's any actual design in nature. And so the theory itself trends in a very decidedly materialistic direction, in which he's denying any actual design. So it isn't clear exactly what he means, but as written, you could not include that. You're right, there isn't an irony. You couldn't include that statement on the front of the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles today, at least if these thought police have their way.
Wow. Boy, that's just an amazing thing. Now, in the meantime, you read the scientific literature, you know what the scientists are saying among themselves, and it's my understanding that there's a lot of doubts even among them, at least in terms of the mechanisms of Darwin. In other words, what we do know is that this stuff doesn't work, so maybe there's some other theory out there somewhere that will explain it, but for now, we're stuck with this and we don't agree with it. But
well,
we can't
right.
tell the public that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's ironic because you have this really dogmatic defense of Darwinian theory going on, so much so that even a statement like that is viewed as a threat to it. But at the same time, and this is one of the reasons I wrote Darwin's Doubt, is that there's a huge disparity between the public presentation of the status of contemporary Darwinian theory called neo-Darwinism, what we all learn about in the textbooks, and the actual status of the theory in the peer-reviewed literature within not just biology but within evolutionary biology itself. Many leading evolutionary biologists are expressing open skepticism about the creative power of the central Darwinian mechanism, the mechanism of natural selection acting on random variations and mutations. It doesn't seem to it seems to be a mechanism that can produce modest changes like helping bacteria acquire antibiotic resistance or helping finches in the Galapagos acquire slightly different shaped beaks in response to differing weather patterns, that type of thing. But it does not seem to have the creative power. In fact, there are many good reasons, and I explain them in the book, as to why the mechanism does not have the power to generate fundamentally new innovations in the history of life. Like, in other words, it doesn't help us to explain the origin of birds or mammals or whole animal body plans in the first place. One scientist has said natural selection explains the survival, mm-hmm. but not the arrival of the fittest. It explains the little stuff, but not the big stuff. And this mm-hmm. is there are many reasons for this. I explain them in the book, but those reasons are also explained in the technical peer-reviewed biological literature. And so while we have these very dogmatic statements about evolutionary theory presented to the public, Richard Dawkins says that if you find someone who's skeptical about evolutionary theory, they're either stupid, ignorant, or insane, and then he says, or possibly wicked. But I prefer not to think about that. So and this is, I think, also the statement you cite from Darwin at the end of The Origin mm-hmm. Illustrates how different Darwin was, at least rhetorically, than his modern proponents. He was rhetorically modest, and this is one of the themes of the book as well, is that there were problems with the theory that he himself acknowledged in The Origin of Species that modern neo-Darwinists would like to sweep under the carpet, at least when they're talking to the public.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, for those not familiar with your book, Darwin's Doubt, just to put it real, here's the real brief version, and you can expand on this if you would. But essentially, Darwin felt that with the fossil record, as much as he knew up to the time he he put his book out, and that book was published in 1859 on the origin of the species. There were some questions about the fossil record actually verifying his theory, and in fact, many evidences pointed to the opposite. But he felt that, hey, if we just keep digging the fossils, we will find the missing links, and my theory will be vindicated. Just keep digging. Now here we are more than 150 years later, and his theory is even in more trouble than at the time that he wrote the book in 1859.
Yeah, he was concerned about an event in the history of life that we call today the Cambrian Explosion. And the Cambrian Explosion refers to the sudden appearance of most of the major large groups of animals called the phyla, the major divisions in the history of life. And the phyla are the animal are specific types of animals that betray or that reveal particular body plans, whole different arrangements of body parts and tissues. So these are the big anatomical designs in the history of life. They come into the fossil record very suddenly, and Darwin was aware that this was contrary to his expectation that life should arise in a very gradual way. He simply didn't find, and we're not finding today, the ancestral precursors of those major groups of animals in the earlier Precambrian rocks. So that's a big mystery that confronted Darwin, and I show that that mystery has become even more acute going forward to the present day. And one of the things that makes it even more mysterious is not just the missing fossils, but what we've learned in the second half of the 20th century and in the first part of our new century about the importance of digital code, of information stored in the DNA molecule and other forms of information that are necessary to build these animals. And that underscores a big engineering problem, in a sense. It raises the question, well, how would the evolutionary process ever build something this complex when it's relying on these random mutational changes, which are essentially copying errors? You wouldn't, you know, think about trying to build a new section of software from a pre-existing section of software by just randomly changing the zeros and ones. It isn't a very efficient way of generating new information. In fact, it's much more likely to degrade and destroy the information you have than to build any new information. And so there's a huge the origin of information is a huge problem associated with any event in the history of life where you see major innovation, and the Cambrian Explosion is the event where you see the greatest amount of innovation, and so it raises this huge information problem that, even as I mentioned, many evolutionary biologists are themselves acknowledging is a real difficulty.
Have you ever heard of Wendell Byrd? Is that name familiar to you at all?
Oh, I know Wendell. Yeah, okay. He's a wonderful guy. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Wendell Byrd is an attorney, Atlanta-based. And he was the one who argued the case on behalf of creation, that basically it was a case involving a law in Louisiana where if they were going to teach evolution in the schools, then creation had to be taught. And the Supreme Court ultimately ruled against that law. In 1987, the decision was called Edwards v. Aguillard. Well, at one point in one of the interviews we've done through the years with Wendell Byrd, he said, you know, if we, instead of using the word creation, and this is before intelligent design took off as a word or phrase to describe, you know, God-based, you know, origins versus evolution-based origins, he said, you know, we could use the phrase abrupt appearances, because that's what we're talking about. We're saying that in the fossil record, all these different types of animals and phyla or whatever appear abruptly, fully formed, without transitional forms. What do you think of that phrase, abrupt appearances? Isn't that basically what we do find?
Well,
in the fossil record?
Well, you find it in the evolutionary literature. There's
The phrase itself.
Oh, sure. There are paleontologists and evolutionary biologists who talk about the abrupt appearance of various forms of life. There's a scientist named Jeffrey Schwartz who's written a book about with the term abrupt appearance in the title. He's an evolutionary biologist, not friendly to a creationist view or an intelligent design view or anything like that. But it's a fact of the fossil record that most of the major groups do appear abruptly. So it's kind of hard not to use the term now and then.
Right, right. All right. What do you think about this idea that there's microevolution, which is small evolutionary changes, kind of like those adaptations that you were describing for the birds in the Galapagos Islands, versus macroevolution. With microevolution, you have a bird, in the middle, a bird in the beginning, a bird in the middle, a bird in the end, just minor small changes within the kind. But with macroevolution, that's the big picture evolution. That's, you know, from one, ultimately one small cell of life, which then, you know, eventually led to what we have today, all of life, including all the 6 billion or so human beings on this planet, et cetera.
Well, oftentimes,
micro versus macro.
If you make that distinction in a rhetorical context,
yes,
defenders of neo-Darwinism will say, well, now you're using creationist terminology. But in fact, the distinction between micro and macro evolution goes back to what's called the modern synthesis, where the modern neo-Darwinian theory was formulated. And the idea of neo-Darwinism is that if you extrapolate small-scale microevolutionary changes, you can eventually produce macroevolutionary innovation. Today, one of the main bones of contention that you find in evolutionary biology literature is from scientists, evolutionary biologists, who question precisely that microevolutionary processes can be extrapolated to account for large-scale macroevolutionary innovation. And there are lots of impediments to the to macroevolutionary change, impediments that constrain the extent to which the neo-Darwinian mechanism can produce change. I discuss one in my book that I think I could explain real quickly right
sure,
now.
Sure, go ahead.
There's a big problem with... if you want to build a new body plan, and a body plan, again, is a unique arrangement of body parts, organs, and tissues. So if you want to fundamentally alter the body architecture of an animal to change one type of animal into another, maybe go from an arthropod to an echinoderm, just as a off the top of the head example.
Okay, I don't even know what you're talking about, but go ahead.
Okay, an arthropod would be something. Oh, and insects are arthropods, or those the trilobite on the front of my book is an arthropod.
There. Okay.
They have articulated exoskeletons and eyes and lots of cool complex organs. But if you want to change something with one fundamental body architecture into another, it turns out that the evolutionary process would have to produce mutations very early in the developmental trajectory of an animal. That is, in the first couple of cell divisions. Because as cells divide, they go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16. And
so early in the life of the organism, not
yes.
early in the life of humanity, or the world.
No, in the process of development,
okay.
from embryo to adult form, you got it. You would have
it has to
have
happen
those.
Real early. Okay.
You have to have it real early. Why? Well, because if the mutation
we have about
occurs
a minute
later
left.
In just a few cells, it's only going to affect those few cells. So it's only the mutations in the first few cell divisions that are going to affect everything downstream.
I see.
But those are precisely the mutations that are not just deleterious, they're not just harmful, they are always lethal. And this is a problem known as the problem of embryonic lethals. And if the organism that's affected by an early acting body plan mutation simply dies...
It'll kill the organism.
And there will be no more evolution. So this is a really serious problem, and I discuss it in Chapter 13 of my book, and it's one of many things that limits the amount of biological change that seems to be possible. So that's why, yeah, sure, if you get late-acting mutations that only affect a few somatic cells, especially ones that aren't heritable, even if they are heritable, in any case, they're only going to affect a little. They're going to have modest changes. Those are the kinds of mutations we see, things that produce modest changes.
Right.
We don't see mutations that affect whole body plans.
Dr. Meyer, discovery.org for more information?
Yes, that's exactly right.
And darwinsdoubt.com?
Right, darwinsdoubt.com. And for people that are interested in this, we have all these young techies at the Institute, and they have created a beautiful YouTube channel of science
super.
Animations and videos and debates that I've done and interviews about the book.
Great.
So there's lots of good material there if people want to dive in.
At darwinsdoubt.com.
At darwinsdoubt.com,
okay,
yeah.
Hey, thanks so much for being with us, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, and Merry Christmas.
Okay.
Happy New Year, right, yeah. Exactly. We've already had Christmas. Okay,
God bless. All right, thank
yeah,
you now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.